Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week over North America and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on news and current events when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We're taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, "He who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client"? What if your carpenter said, "He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client"? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who couldn't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about these budding young lawyers. He said, quote, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." And he said it's worse than that. Most of the students actually graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom and without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen, Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can order yours right now. And remember, courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Or call direct. It's 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Well, let's see what the Bush administration is up to. George Bush is working hard to get reelected, and he's coming up with some neat proposals. Here's a good one. He says, this is an exclusive, Republicans plan to push for elimination of the IRS. That's a breath of fresh air, isn't it? A domestic counterpiece or centerpiece of the Bush GOP agenda for a second Bush term is getting rid of the Internal Revenue Service. Or so the Drudge Report has learned. Now, the Speaker of the House will push for replacing the nation's current tax system with a national sales tax or a value-added tax, Hill sources tell Drudge. People ask me if I'm really calling for the elimination of the IRS, and I say I think that it's a great thing to do for future generations of Americans. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert explains in his new book, to be released on Wednesday. Pushing reform legislation will be difficult. Change of any sort seldom comes easy. But these changes are critical to our economic vitality and our economic security abroad. Hastert declares in Speaker, lessons from 40 years in coaching and politics. Now, if you own property, stock, or say 100 acres of farmland and tax time is approaching, you don't want to make a mistake, so you're almost obliged to go to a certified public accountant tax preparer or a tax attorney to help you file a correct return. That costs a lot of money. Now multiply the amount that you have to pay by the total number of people who are in the same boat. You can't, and no one can, because precise numbers don't exist. But we can stipulate that we're talking about a huge amount. Now consider that a flat tax, national sales tax, or a value-added tax, would not only eliminate the need to do this, it could also eliminate the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS itself, and make the process of paying taxes much easier. By adopting a value-added tax, sales tax, or some other initiative, we could begin to change productivity. And if you can do that, you can change gross national product and start growing the economy. You could double the economy over the next 15 years, and all of a sudden, the problem of what future generations owe in Social Security and Medicare won't be so daunting anymore. The answer is to grow the economy. And the key to doing that is making sure that we have a tax system that attracts capital and builds incentives to keep it here instead of forcing it out to other nations. Well, this value-added tax is a type of tax that they have in Europe. The Europeans pay in the neighborhood of 60% of everything that they create and produce in taxes. We Americans pay much less than that on average. However, the taxes can take up to 76%. You have 14 taxes here in the United States. Now, what we need here, he's telling us, is that we're going to replace the income tax with a national sales tax. Let me ask you this. How do you think that's going to work out? Does anybody ever take a minute and say, well, gosh, let me get a pen and paper out here, and let me see how this is going to work? Now, let's take that number for a minute. What is the percentage that the federal government is going to add on to this value-added tax? You know, is there a number here that we could hang our hats on? Well, in my state, Missouri, they're taking 7% for the sales tax. Now, let me ask you this. Do you think that in the event that they put on a, you know, let's say a 10% sales tax at the national level, did you think for a minute now that they might remove the sales tax from Missouri, California, and Florida? Or do you think this national sales tax is going to be maybe added on to that? In Europe, they just added on to it. Now, let's suppose that you need to go out and buy some food, and food is kind of a necessity, you know. So you go out and you want to buy your grocery basket, and your grocery basket, let's say the tab is $100 for this week's grocery bill. And the sales tax is $7, so that's $107, and the national sales tax is 10%, so that's $117 for the food bill this week. Well, that sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? If we didn't have to pay any income tax, you know, just eliminate the income tax, that 10% would be pretty attractive, wouldn't it? Now, our income tax right now, the top rate is 28%, and the minimum rate is around 17%. And let's see, we still have our Social Security tax, that's 16%, plus our property taxes, plus our capital gain taxes, plus is this guy Hastert suggesting that we're going to eliminate the capital gain tax, maybe? Well, I didn't see anything in this article that would suggest that we're going to eliminate, let's say, your property tax, Social Security tax, or maybe your corporate tax, or Medicare tax, or unemployment tax, do you see what I'm telling you? If all you're going to do is take off the income tax, and you don't have a cap on the national sales tax, can you tell me, please, how this benefits anybody? I mean, can it benefit anybody? Now, if you're making $100,000 a year and the national sales tax is 10%, you only have to pay 10% of what you spend. So if you're not spending your money, you know you're investing $20,000, $30,000 a year, in stocks or bonds or real estate or something else, then there isn't any value-added tax to pay, is there? But if you're a wage earner and you're down here earning $20,000 or $30,000 a year, and you spend all of it, you know, buying gasoline and buying all these goods and services that you have in order to eke out a living, won't you be paying 10% of everything you create and produce to pay this value-added tax? So when the critics say that this is a tax that's disproportionate on the poorer people in the country, or those that make less, and it's really a neat deal for those that pay more, maybe they've got a point. You know, God came up with a plan. He said, in order to run government, we need a thing called a tithe, and it takes 10% of what you create and produce. It's an income tax, is what it is. It's an income tax that falls on everybody, whether you make $10,000 a year or $10 million a year. And God Almighty, the creator of the universe, thought that that was an equitable system, but we came along and said, no, it's not equitable. We have to have a progressive graduated income tax. We have to improve upon God's mistake. Well, we've been using this income tax now for about 80 or 90 years, and now we've come to the conclusion that maybe it's not as good as we thought it was. I've never talked to anybody that was very happy about the income tax, but in 1996, when the question of this flat tax came up, remember, flat tax, the Republicans rejected Steve Forbes soundly and nominated, can't think of his name now, he used to be the head of the Senate there, but I'll think of his name here in a second, and Clinton and Bob Dole, that's what it was, Bob Dole. Clinton and Dole both agreed that we want to keep the income tax. They didn't give you a choice. But could it be that this income tax, the income tax as we know it today, this progressive income tax, the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, has led our country to ruin? And that now we got to come up with a different plan? A different plan to generate more money than the income tax can produce. The Europeans have the value-added tax, and the net result is they pay more tax per capita than we Americans do. It's bad here, but it's worse there. And now, Dennis Hastert's writing a book telling us that what we need to do is to adopt the European plan, the European system. Well, boys and girls, isn't that what we did back in 1907? Weren't we listening to the European plan when they said what you Americans need is a central bank like all the nations of Europe? That was the Rothschild Bank. They sent their minion over here and said, look, go sell this to the Americans, and he did. They sold the concept of the income tax along with the central bank to us from 1907 to 1913 when it was finally enacted. Think about that. We bought into the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto with the central bank idea. We bought into the income tax, which is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, when we bought in to the income tax. Now we're being asked to buy into the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all property in land in America. When you put a value-added tax, a sales tax, what you're saying in effect is, we're going to charge you to spend your money. In America today, they charge us to earn it, and now they want to charge us to spend it. Are you really sure that a value-added tax is what you want? Because once you get it, you're going to be stuck with it for the next 80 or 90 years, just like we have been with the income tax. I don't deny that the income tax needs to be abolished or replaced, that the second and fifth planks to the Communist Manifesto need to be changed, and we Americans need to reject it. But to jump onto the European bandwagon and pick up on this value-added tax, I think, is a step in the wrong direction. The value-added tax is a bad move. Stand by. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Tonight's report on news and current events. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class. This class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do, both at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, citation, or a complaint. You know, rule number one in pro se litigation is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. All of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you, and your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, or indeed, in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" That comes from U.S. versus Dickerson. A second judge said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." That comes from Belknap versus United States. And the third judge said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and far-sighted." And that comes from Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can order yours right now by simply calling 417-273-4967. And keep in mind that courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. You know, we've been practicing free trade in this country now for about, since 1933 with Franklin D. Roosevelt. He came up with a brand new idea and said, you know, we Americans ought to open our borders, and the other countries in the world ought to open their borders, and we'll have free trade, and it'll work out just like the United States having free trade between Arkansas and California, or Florida and Michigan. It's a great concept. In our country, it's worked wonderfully. And that's because at the beginning, our country was populated by Anglo-Saxons, Israelites, people that all had a common heritage. What these people are trying to accomplish here is that we're going to take people of all different races and ethnic backgrounds and religious and political and philosophical ideas and ideologies, people that don't have anything in common, you know, like Chinese and Brazilians, and we're going to merge them into a world order, a more George Bush calls it a kinder and gentler world, I guess. And we're gonna have a utopian New World Order. This is a view. It's a philosophical ideology. And we're well on the way to doing that. In the process, though, we've had to make some changes in our legal system. That is, we Americans used to practice what we called the common law. It was the common law of England. That common law was codified by a fellow named Alfred the Great back in 872 A.D., and he codified it from the Mosaic Law, which was codified by God Almighty through his agent Moses, put in the Ark of the Covenant. And we Anglo-Saxons have been using that. It's called Anglo-Saxon administration for about 3,100 years. One of the cornerstones of Anglo-Saxon administration is thou shalt not steal, which is the basic law, the basic tenet of the concept of private property. Private property. It's the exact opposite from the concept of from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. It's a wild new concept here in the 21st century. But let me show you what's happened when we abandoned our common law and adopted communism, or from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. 1/3 of the United States machine tool shops have perished since 2000. Now, 2000 is just 4 years ago. Can you remember that back, far back, you know, 2000, the year 2000? 1/3. Tooling craft is rapidly vanishing, and 16,000 jobs in the state lost since 1997, and many of them are moving to China. China. Madison Heights, this is Michigan. Interstate Tool and Die looks like so many of the low-slung cinder block tool-making shops clustered around 13 Mile and Stephenson Highway in this aging suburb. The 77-year-old business is filled with nearly obsolete machinery operated by toolmakers. They average 55 years old, who started their craft right after high school and until recently earned up to $80,000 a year, working 6 days a week. Now, $80,000 a year is pretty good pay. You know, $100,000 a year in the United States puts you in the top 5% of income earners. Now, the once vital cogs in the nation's manufacturing sector, small tool and die shops such as Interstate are becoming symbols of a rapidly vanishing era. Interstate is being killed by fierce, cheaper foreign competition, a shortage of young, skilled labor, a changing U.S. economy, and escalating costs. Many in the industry fear it is the death of a 20th century American tradition in which veteran craftsmen create the precise mechanical tools used to mass produce everything from computer chips to car and truck parts. U.S. toolmakers were once so coveted that they were exempt from the draft during World War II. Now they're losing out to foreign workers who often earn $2 an hour. $2 an hour. Hey, that's pretty good for Chinese labor, isn't it? $2 an hour. Now, do you want to buy a former tool and die shop on Stephenson? Well, just pick your color, Christopher Kirsch said. In August, the business run by Kirsch, 35, and his father, Carl Kirsch, 60, and founded by Carl's grandfather, will permanently close its doors. And late last month, Interstate sent a 3-page letter to its remaining customers explaining its demise. It had tinges of bitterness. We have, due to a lack of responsibility, respect, integrity, and loyalty, been reduced to a nameless entity with no past record or performance standing, the letter said. And this situation would be much easier to accept had we intentionally or willingly lost our desire or capability. The company joins the dozen or so tool and die shops in Madison Heights that have gone out of business in the past 2 years. About 4,000, or one-third, of the nation's tool and die shops have perished since 2000, wiping away 100,000 jobs or more, according to the National Tooling and Machinist Association, an industry trade group in Michigan. More than 16,000 tool and die jobs have disappeared since 1997, according to the State Labor Department. Now, fewer than 10,000 tool and die shops remain in the United States, and the National Toolmakers Group estimates the national data about the number of toolmakers' positions that remain is expected to be released this month by the U.S. Department of Labor. This kind of downturn and this type of job loss have never occurred before, said Matthew Coffey. He's the president of the National Machinist Group. The automotive sector is particularly hard hit. I got to stop right here. I got to make a little editorial comment. I want to point out that the toolmakers that are now being outsourced to China are simply following the other industries in America that have been outsourced to China, Japan, or Bangladesh, or someplace else in this new craze. I call it a new craze that we began with the New Deal, Fair Deal back in the 1930s. So it isn't something that's peculiar just to Democrats or just to George Bush and the Republicans, but it's the policy that America has been following now for the last 80 years. And that is, we want to merge the world into a new world order. We want to tear down trade barriers, and we want to eliminate protectionism. Now, under the old system, under our Constitution and Bill of Rights, our founding fathers believed that America comes first, China, Japan, Bangladesh, Brazil, and the rest of the world comes second. I know it's a wild new concept. It's totally selfish and has nothing to do with being kinder and gentler, but it has a lot to do with the well-being, with the standard of living, and with the lifestyle of Americans as opposed to all the rest of the people in the world, commonly called the pagan nations around us. Well, we got a bug in our bonnet, and we decided that we wanted to create a melting pot in America, that instead of having a nation of Anglo-Saxons, we would have a nation composed of all of the peoples of the world. I mean, we'll have Chinese and Japanese, and we'll have Buddhists, and we'll have Christians and Muslims and Jews, and we'll just bring all these people together. And of course, each and every one of these the separate groups have their own agenda, don't they? I mean, just take a look. You've got all these Mexicans coming across the border, and the Mexicans that are here are waving and cheering and say, "Bring them on! We want more." Well, the Chinese in this country are doing the same thing. Hey, listen, we need more Chinese in this country. As a result of that, what's happened over the last 40 years, from 1960 on, is that the white Anglo-Saxon population, those English and Irish and Scots and, you know, the French, the Europeans, have declined from 90% of the population to 68%. And we're going to comprise just 50% of the population over the next 40 years. That's a pretty significant change. What we're in effect doing is throwing our heritage and our country away and giving it to foreigners and aliens around us. We are practicing what's known in the Bible as the prodigal son syndrome. We have despised our inheritance and now we're throwing it away. And this is the outgrowth of it. That's all. We are not protecting American jobs at $80,000, and after all, why should we? Just picture this. You're a manager of a manufacturing company here in the United States. Let's call yourselves the Stanley Tool Company. And you've opened your border to Chinese tools, Japanese tools, and every other tool in the world. And they can sell their tools in this country. And they're only paying $2 an hour for their labor in China or Japan. And you're paying how much? $20, $30, $40 an hour for your tool makers and for your machinists in the United States? Come on. That's why the Stanley Tool Works up in Connecticut moved their operations overseas. That's why all of America's businesses are moving their operations overseas. It's the political policy of both the Republicans and the Democrats. I don't care whether you vote in Kerry or George Bush. You're going to have more of the same because this is the policy of the New World Order. Now, I don't think it's a very good policy for America, and I don't think opening your doors to everybody else in the world and throwing away your inheritance was a very bright idea. You don't see the Chinese opening their doors to the Turks or the Muslims and saying, come on in and take over China now, do you? I'm kind of at a loss to see how that benefits Americans or Anglo-Saxons, but, you know, the deed is done. It's done. And we had this very same thing come up when we left Egypt. God told us to go spy out the land and we'd go conquer it. We sent out 12 spies. 10 of them came back with a bad report and the people said, we're not going to do it. So God said, okay, you'll die out here in the wilderness. Well, we changed our tune when we saw the writing on the wall. And so we said, well, we'll go do it. And God told us, don't waste your time because I'm not going to be with you. And so we went out to war anyway and we got soundly trashed. Well, you know, God told us not to make covenants and contracts with the foreign and alien nations around us. And we said, well, God, you made a mistake, so we're going to fix that. And we went out and we made NATO and CETO, and now we've got GATT and NAFTA, and we've made all these treaties. So if you think that it's now time to make a change and go back and we're going to do something different and correct our mistake, I think you're whistling Dixie through a straw hat. This nation is going into national captivity, and that comes after we have a national economic collapse. We're on the verge of having that. And you've got two skull and bones New World Order people running for the presidency of the United States. You know, Bush and Kerry, both of them practice witchcraft. Both of them are dedicated communists, although they call themselves New World Order advocates. They're not communists anymore. But their socialist philosophies don't have anything in common with thou shalt not steal or the God of the Bible. Just thought I'd share that with you. So if you lose your job, remember that you're the proximate cause of your own injury. Now hang on, we'll be back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, Charles Lyell was one of the pillars of modern geology, and he published his Principles of Geology in the early 1800s. Lyell's concepts are so widely accepted today that most who believe them don't even know who it was that originated them. Well, it was Charles Lyell. And it's from Lyell's system of reasoning that a doctrine of origins was devised by simply projecting all natural processes back through time indefinitely. And that way, catastrophes like Noah's flood are strictly ruled out. And this process is called science. Well, listen to this. The sun is shrinking. Now, the Newswire report made that surprising statement some time back. It reported to us that the sun's diameter appears to have been decreasing by about 0.1% per century. Scientists have been watching this process for over 100 years, and the evidence is now conclusive. Every hour, the sun is shrinking by about 5 feet. Now, if the sun is shrinking 0.1% per century, then it totals 1% per millennium. And if the sun existed only 100,000 years ago, it would have been double its present diameter. And if it was doing this for 20 million years, just count back 20 million years ago, the surface of the sun would be touching the Earth. Now, as far as researchers can tell, this rate of shrinkage has been consistent since the origin of the sun. Now, what did our teachers tell us about this dinosaur extinction? Wasn't that 65 million years ago? Well, if the sun was touching the orbit of the Earth 20 million years ago, then what were those dinosaurs doing 65 million years ago? Now, listen, boys and girls, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, you know, to do the math on this kind of pseudo-scientific lie. And that's just one more of the many examples of evolutionary propaganda masquerading under the guise of science. And this is just one more of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School that I conduct twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Here's a science article. Science article dealing with oil. Listen to this. About 80 miles off the coast of Louisiana lies a mostly submerged mountain, the top of which is known as Eugene Island. The portion underwater is an eerie-looking sloping tower jutting up from the depths of the Gulf of Mexico, with deep fissures and perpendicular faults which spontaneously grew or spew natural gas. And a significant reservoir of crude oil was discovered nearby in the late 1960s, and by 1970, a platform named Eugene 330 was busily producing about 15,000 barrels of oil a day, and it was very high-quality crude oil at that. Well, by the late 1980s, the platform's production had slipped to less than 4,000 barrels per day, and it was considered pumped out. Now, done, completed. Suddenly, in 1990, production soared back to 15,000 barrels a day, and the reserves, which had been estimated at 60 million barrels in the 1970s, were recalculated at around 400 million barrels. Now, interestingly, the measured geological age of the new oil was quantifiably different from the oil pumped out in the 1970s. Now, I want to repeat that. The measured geological age of this new oil that's coming out in the 1990s, was quantifiably different than the oil that was being pumped out in the 1970s. Now, analysis of seismic recordings revealed the presence of a deep fault at the base of the Eugene Island Reservoir, which was gushing up a river of oil from some deeper and previously unknown source. Similar results were seen by other Gulf of Mexico oil wells, and similar results were found in the Cook Inlet oil fields in Alaska. Similar results were found in oil fields in Uzbekistan and similarly in the Middle East, where oil exploration and extraction have been underway for at least the last 20 years or more, and these known reserves have doubled. And currently, there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 680 billion barrels of Mideast oil in reserve. Now, creating that much oil would take a big pile of dead dinosaurs and fermenting prehistoric plants. Now, could there be another source for crude oil? An intriguing theory now permeating oil company research staff suggests that crude oil may actually be a natural inorganic product, not a stepchild of unfathomable time and organic degradation. The theory suggests that there may be huge, yet to be discovered reserves of oil at depths that dwarf current world estimates. The theory is simple. Crude oil forms as a natural inorganic process, which occurs between the mantle and the crust, somewhere between 5 and 20 miles deep, and the proposed mechanism is as follows. Methane, CH4, is a common molecule found in quantity throughout our solar system. Huge concentrations exist at great depth in the Earth, and at the mantle crust interface, roughly 20,000 feet beneath the surface, rapidly rising streams of compressed methane-based gases hit pockets of high temperature, causing the condensation of heavier hydrocarbons. The product of this condensation is commonly known as crude oil. Some compressed methane-based gases migrate into pockets and reservoirs that we extract as natural gas. In the geologically cooler, more tectonically stable regions around the globe, the crude oil pools into reservoirs. In the hotter, more volcanic and tectonically active areas, the oil and natural gas continue to condense and eventually to oxidize, producing carbon dioxide and steam, which exits from active volcanoes. Periodically, depending on variations of geology and earth movement, oil seeps to the surface in quantity, creating the vast oil sand deposits of Canada and Venezuela, or the continual seeps found beneath the Gulf of Mexico and Uzbekistan. Periodically, depending on variations of geology, the vast deep pools of oil break free and then replenish existing known reservoirs of oil. There are a number of observations across the oil-producing regions of the world that support this theory, and the list of proponents begins with Mendeleev, who created the periodic table of elements, and includes Dr. Thomas Gold, the founder and director of Cornell University Center for Radiophysics and Space Research, and Dr. J.F. Kinney of Gas Resources Corporations in Houston, Texas. In his 1999 book, The Deep Hot Biosphere, Dr. Gold presents compelling evidence for inorganic oil formation, and he notes that geologic structures where oil is found all correspond to deep earth formations, not the haphazard depositions that we find with sedimentary rock associated to fossils or even current surface life. And he also notes that oil extracted from varying depths from the same oil field have the same chemistry. Oil chemistry does not vary as fossils vary with increasing depth. And also interesting is the fact that oil is found in huge quantities among geographic formations where assays of prehistoric life are not sufficient to produce the existing reservoirs of oil. Well, then where did it all come from then? Another interesting fact is that every oil field throughout the world has outgassing helium. Helium is so often present in oil fields that helium detectors are used as oil prospecting tools. Helium is an inert gas known to be a fundamental product of the radiological decay of uranium and thorium, identified in quantity at great depths below the surface of the Earth, 200 or more miles deep. It is not found in meaningful quantities in areas that are not producing methane, oil, or natural gas. It is not a member of the dozen or so common elements associated with life, and it is found throughout the solar system as a thoroughly inorganic product. Even more intriguing is evidence that several oil reservoirs around the world are refilling themselves, such as the Eugene Island Reservoir. Not from the sides, as would be expected from concurrent organic reservoirs, but from the bottom up. And Dr. Gold strongly believes that oil is a renewable, primordial soup continually manufactured by the Earth under ultra-hot conditions and tremendous pressures. And as this substance migrates toward the surface, it is attached by bacteria, making it appear to have an organic origin dating back to the dinosaurs. Smaller oil companies and innovative teams are using this theory to justify deep oil drilling in Alaska and in the Gulf of Mexico, among other locations, with some success. And Dr. Kenny is on record predicting that parts of the Siberian continent contain a deep reservoir of oil equal to or exceeding that already discovered in the Middle East. Now, could this be true? Well, in August of 2002, in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Dr. Kenny published a paper which had a partial title of The Genesis of Hydrocarbons and the Origin of Petroleum. And Kenny and three Russian co-authors conclude that the hydrogen-carbon system does not spontaneously evolve hydrocarbons at pressures less than 30 kbars, even in the most favorable environment. The HC system evolves hydrocarbons under pressures found in the mantle of the Earth and at temperatures consistent with that environment. He was quoted as stating that competent physicists, chemists, chemical engineers, and men knowledgeable of thermodynamics have known that natural petroleum does not evolve from biological materials since the last quarter of the 19th century. Deeply entrenched in our culture, however, is the belief that at some point in the relatively near future, we will see the last working pump on the last functioning oil well screech and rattle, and that'll be that, the end of the age of oil. And unless we find another source of cheap energy, the world will rapidly become a much darker and a much dangerous or much more dangerous place. So if Dr. Gold and Dr. Kenny are correct, this, the end of the world as we know it, scenario simply is not going to happen. Well, think about it. While not inexhaustible, deep earth reservoirs of inorganic crude oil and commercially feasible extraction would provide the world with generations of low-cost fuel. And Dr. Gold has been quoted saying that current worldwide reserves of crude oil could be off by a factor of more than 100. A Hedberg conference sponsored by the American Association of Petroleum Geologists was scheduled to discuss and publicly debate this issue. Papers are solicited from interested academics and professionals, and the conference was scheduled to begin June 9, 2003, but was canceled at the last minute. A new date is yet to be set. I produced a series of articles or programs here on this thing called Peak Oil. And I pointed out then that peak oil is coming, whether we like it or not. But it's really not physical, it's political. It's political. It's a tool being used by the world geopoliticians to foment discontent and hate to create this new world order. In fact, I said at that time, before I read this article here, that the world's known reserves of oil are a trillion barrels today. And that National Geographic pointed out 30 years ago that the known oil reserves in the world were probably underestimated by a factor of 100. That's right. That'd be 100 trillion barrels, but you're not supposed to know that. All right, hang on. We'll be back with the last segment here when we return, so don't go away. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. He was the former editor of the New York Tribune when he said to the New York Press Association on February the 26th, 1936, he said that there's no such thing as a free and independent press in America unless it's in some country town. And there's not one of you who dares express an honest opinion because you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid $150 a week, he said, for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid for doing similar things. If I should permit my honest opinion to be printed in one issue of my paper, like Othello, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. Our business is to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his race and his country for his daily bread. We are, he said, the tools of rich men behind the scenes. We are intellectual prostitutes. Well, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. These are men and families like the Windsors, the Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, Vanderbilts, and Kissingers, and now the Careys. Now, I say it's time that we wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all of these crazy scientists, philosophers, and preachers and politicians, and let you and I prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. If you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy in this New World Order, why don't you call and order my 4-hour compact disc package? Remember, it's educational, entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free. And you can call right now to order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Here's a story about political snitches monitoring your sermons. Groups threaten churches with loss of tax-exempt status over activism. What's that all about? You mean you preachers can't talk about George Bush and John Kerry, the political process, sodomy, or the many social and political issues of the day? Yeah, that's right. You can't. Now, at least two organizations are monitoring the content of Sunday sermons by United States pastors and threatening to report churches to the Internal Revenue Service if they hear political messages that they deem to be inappropriate under federal guidelines on tax-exempt status. Did you get that, boys and girls? Earlier this week, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, headed by Barry Lynn, filed a complaint with the IRS against Ronnie Floyd, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Springdale, Arkansas, accusing him of preaching a sermon promoting President Bush's reelection on July the 4th. Well, that's a good point. If we're going to have separation of church and state, then the churches ought not to have 501c3 tax exemption granted by the state, should they? Because if they do, then they're state entities and state institutions. Should these state institutions, financed by tax exemption, be given political rights? Well, this group doesn't think so. Now, the complaint challenges the church's tax-exempt status as a religious organization. Now, Lynn's letter to the IRS read in part, it said, "The pastor's description of the candidate's stands and their personal religious beliefs was obviously aimed at encouraging the congregants to cast ballots for George Bush. The church is known for its stands on social issues and its opposition to legal abortion and gay rights." Let's think about this for a minute. You're getting tax-exempt status. Well, tax exemption is the exact same thing as a tax subsidy. A tax subsidy is where the government sends you a check. Tax exemption is where you don't have to pay a tax. It amounts to exactly the same thing. America's tax-exempt churches are tax-supported state church institutions. And so the question arises, should these state church tax-supported institutions preach sermons favoring political outcomes? This group doesn't think so. I have to agree with them. I don't think that state churches should express political ideology. And I'm not in favor of separation of church and state, and neither were our founding fathers. But then our founding fathers didn't grant tax-exempt status to churches. That's because all churches already have tax-exempt status. You don't have to incorporate and get 501c3 tax exemption to have tax exemption. Churches already have it by going down and incorporating and applying for 501c3 tax exemption. What you church people are doing is going to the state to have the state regulate and control you under Hale versus Hinkle and Wickard versus Filburn. After all, boys and girls, you church people, it's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the laws for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Churches are subsidized under 501c3. Now, should those state church subsidized institutions be out there encouraging or leading the debate on such political issues as stem cell research, abortion, taxes, or political candidates? Well, ask yourself this. Should the Department of Agriculture or the Interior Department or any other government institution be out here promoting these political agendas? Well, mull it over. Think about it. Lynn's letter to the IRS objected, and the church is known for its stands on social issues and its opposition to legal abortion, gay rights, and by lauding Bush's stands on these and other issues, and attacking Senator John Kerry, Floyd, the preacher, was plainly telling his congregation to be sure to vote for Bush. Now, I've enclosed a videotape that includes the entire sermon as well as a partial transcript. About 45 minutes into the message, Floyd begins to discuss the differences between Bush and Kerry. And please note that even the imagery employed by the church is designed to promote Bush. A huge photo of Bush is projected onto a screen that shows the president next to an American flag. By contrast, small photos of Kerry are used that show him as one person in a larger crowd. In addition, Bush is shown signing a ban on late-term abortions, an act most church members will laud, while Kerry is shown as one of a group of senators who opposed a law banning same-sex marriage, a stand most church members will likely oppose. Organizations granted tax-free status under federal law may not participate at all in campaign activity for or against political candidates according to published IRS guidelines. Did you, church people, know that? Did you know that your 501c3 tax exemption prohibits you from taking any political stand? You cannot teach, preach, or take a stand against homosexuals or take a stand against abortion. Did you know that? I just thought I'd share that with you. Well, not and keep your tax-exempt status. Now, the purpose for giving you this tax-exempt status is to silence you. It's to shut you up. Now, back during our revolutionary period, the churches and the preachers were not muzzled, and they were up busily preaching their sermons against the British. And they didn't get any tax exemption from King George. They paid their taxes, and they went out there, and they told the people in the churches what they thought of King George and what they thought of the government. A guy by the name of Pete Peters has a little church out in Colorado, and he took a political stand against gay rights. It was about, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe, or something on that order. Anyway, the moral of the story was is that he lost his 501c3 tax-exempt status, and they came in, fined him. They didn't pay the fines, and they sold the church. I mean, the government came in and shut that church down. Well, after all, Peter's church was a government church. And the government church was preaching a line that was anti-government, so the government came in and shut down this anti-government church. Now, if you want free speech, you're entitled to that under the First Amendment. And if you want to speak out against government, stem cell research, or abortion, or gay rights, or lesbianism, or whatever it is, politics in general, then you've got to have the capacity to exercise free speech. And 501c3 muzzles you. You might tuck that one away in your heart. Now, according to IRS regulations, tax-exempt organizations are absolutely prohibited from directly or indirectly participating in or intervening in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for elective public office, contributions to political campaign funds, or public statements of position, verbal or written, made on behalf of the organization in favor of or in opposition to any candidate for public office, clearly violates the prohibition against political campaign activity. And violation of this prohibition may result in denial or revocation of tax-exempt status and the imposition of certain excise taxes. You want to keep in mind that in America today, there are 330,000 churches. 330,000 churches with 330,000 pastors that are all muzzled, silenced. But there are 6,000 churches in the United States that aren't. 6,000 churches that are not 501c3 churches. So, tuck that one away in your hearts there, pastors, and there's a way for you people to unincorporate and to get your capacity and freedoms back. I think that Mormons, Catholics, Protestants, and Jews ought to speak out. I may not agree with your views, but I think you have a right to speak, and that you ought to speak. I don't think that this pastor down in Arkansas ought to be silenced. But he is the proximate cause of his own injury. He has silenced himself. He has gone to the government and said, I want government protections. I want government money. And as a result of that, he's got the government protection and the government money. But as a side issue, he has now lost his power to speak, as did Pete Peters. Now, Peters is now unincorporated, and Peters can now speak. And there are 6,000 other churches with 6,000 other pastors across the nation that can come out and speak their minds. This is right and that's wrong. I think that's good. I think more preachers should be out here preaching and teaching the law of God. This is right, that's wrong. But what we're finding, not just in the United States, but I'll show you in programs to come, that what we're facing here worldwide is a silencing of the church and a silencing of God and a silencing of the law of God from the Bible. In Sweden, in Europe, not just in countries that are dictatorial or that are China or North Korea. I'm talking about Sweden, Norway, Denmark, England, France, Ireland, European countries that we look to as the bastions of the Protestant Reformation. Those pastors, those churches, those ideas are being silenced by a minority. All right, I'm out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, God willing, goodbye, friends.